You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars, and with you for the next 45, 50 minutes, and of course, with a very special guest here on the show, starting in the next segment. Her name is Francesca Tarrant. She's a Briton. She's been here for 18 months. And we're going to talk a little bit about her time here and some interesting subjects about Colombia, in particular the Armero disaster that took place 30 years ago this November, where she, Francesca, just visited this haunting, destroyed, abandoned town. And we'll talk about Puerto Triunfo and the Hacienda Napoles, Escobar's country mansion in the Middle Magdalena region, and what's become of that. And of course, this gives a rise to a chat about historical legacies and whether we should be destroying or denying the past, because Colombia is a country trying to come to grips with an identity at the moment, like so many other countries. It's not alone in this, but we're in this post, almost into a post-conflict, almost into a post, not post-violence, because that will continue, of course, but is Colombia right to be turning its back on the legacy and the history of Pablo Escobar? This is something that we discuss with Francesca in the next segments of this show. Very interesting to talk to her, very erudite young lady from London. And so don't miss out. This is a very good chat. So yesterday, Sunday, we had a big march here, all over the country and internationally. It was the March for Life. And it wasn't for peace, it was for life. It was organized mainly by Antanas Mockus, that's how you pronounce his name in Lithuanian, because he's of Lithuanian descent, the former, I guess several mayors ago, but the former mayor of Bogota, several time presidential hopeful, Antanas Mockus. Started this march for life, to reject the hatred in the country. It was well attended. We have not seen what the result is yet, but it was well attended on this blazing sunshine on Sunday, all day Sunday. People were out with their banners, and it was a feeling, more of a carnival type feeling out there. So good times in Bogota, and plenty of hope for the future. Yeah, and by chance, those of you out there know I did a Masters in Conflict Resolution a couple of years ago now. By chance, I ran into an old teacher in the street, and so I had the opportunity to sort of corner him in the 2 or 3 minutes I was able to talk to him. An expert on transitional justice, his name, Gustavo Salazar. Anyway, so I wondered, with the FARC saying all these things, with the peace talks going on in Cuba, and with the FARC saying that they're not going to spend any time in jail, no guerrilla will spend any time in jail. He said, there will be jail time. It's just a question of working out how to ease it in. And there will be jail time. And it's an interesting situation. But the most positive, progress in the peace dialogues in all of this time since November 2012 is that on Saturday night, an agreement between the FARC and the government came to in that they will start to demine together. They will start to eradicate landmines in the country. Now, these aren't formal landmines built in Italy, the UK, or Singapore. These are landmines, homemade ones, built with plastic syringes, placed up by water sources, you know, to engender the most fear and destruction in local communities. So this is immense. The guerrilla members will be dressed as civilians, and they will indeed be accompanying the military's engineer department in demining certain areas. I imagine they'll start in the the department of Antioquia, because that seems to be one of the most mined places, perhaps Cauca. But this is a huge step forward. I mean, the first really tangible agreement to come out of the peace dialogue. So we must all be supporting these right now, because if it's just one thing, one scourge that we can get rid of, that's the only thing that comes out of these dialogues. This is very, very positive indeed for the rural communities across Colombia who've been, you know, plagued by this terror. Anyway, so that's me out now. We'll be right back with Francesca Tarrant talking all about Colombia. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. Don't go away. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. We're here in Bogota. And like every week, we have a very special guest on the show. It's all about the interviews. It's all about people doing interesting things here in Colombia, because it's a Colombia-based show. Anyway, I'm here with Francesca Tarrant, who is a Briton. She's been here for 18 months. Her partner's a diplomat, so we can't talk about that. Probably the most interesting thing about it. No, I'm lying. Her partner's a diplomat at the British Embassy. But aside from that, we want to talk about her time here and her feelings about Colombia. So, Francesca, welcome on Colombia Calling.
Thank you very much.
Now, we've made an English morning for you, because we've got Earl Grey tea, we've got the teapot out, even our coasters have St. Paul's on them.
It's taking me back.
It's taking you back. Now, yes. Do you miss home?
Do you know, I don't. I think I spent my childhood travelling between France and England. Although London was very much my base, I do love it. I actually feel compelled to return to Colombia whenever I pop back on any trips to Europe. So I actually see this more as my home for the moment, which is a slightly odd feeling, I think, for some of the friends and family I've left behind, but nonetheless.
That's fine. I mean, but also, I mean, that's great, because then that really means that your home is where your partner is.
Yeah, well, home is where we've established a life, and I think Colombia has been incredibly welcoming for us, despite the reputation that it has overseas and despite the words of warning that we were given prior to moving here. I have to say, it's been a universally pleasant experience, and a country that's opened us with open arms.
I know, it really is. It is a very comfortable country to live in. And you know, a few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to speak with this sort of character who slipped through the cracks of society, the Mick, yes. Christopher Kavanagh, who's a subject of a new book. But anyway, I had you know, he was jailed here in 1986 for trying to smuggle cocaine back to the UK. But I had the opportunity to chat with him, and you know, we were both in agreement. There's not a lot of things we agree on. Me being English and him being Irish, we were both in agreement that even him living in his situation of relative poverty and me living comfortably here,
yes,
have an enviable lifestyle.
Indeed. No, I think the quality of life here is incredible, and whether you're in Bogota or located outside or travelling around, there's no shortage of very nice, pleasant experiences that one can enjoy.
It's true. Now, I know you travel a lot, because we're friends on Facebook.
Yes.
So I get to see, well, I'm stuck here, you know, creating a nursery in my apartment and losing my office. I see your photos on Facebook out there, traveling the country, exploring yourself, having a great time of it all. You were recently, though, in perhaps... well, first of all, let's start with you. Recently, I saw photos of you at Puerto Triunfo, so you were in Escobar's mansion up there.
We were.
Up there, Hacienda Napolis.
Hacienda Napolis, indeed. Well, we try and get out and about as much as we can. I think if you've got a fixed time in a country, which we do, a three-year posting, then there's the temptation to kind of take advantage of every possible weekend, long weekend, trip away. So where we can, we hit the road and drive around visiting new places, and I guess slightly off the beaten track for most international tourists, because it's not one of the big tourism destinations, is Hacienda Nápoles, which was Escobar's country retreat, now transformed into a kind of glorified safari park, Longleat type.
Longleat. Longleat without so many animals.
Without so many animals, exactly. Half a Longleat, perhaps. And what I thought was a bit sad about visiting that was that they're increasingly removing any reference to Escobar. The museum's now gone. His house there is in actual rack and ruin. I mean, it really
it
is
fell
in
down
pieces.
This week.
Yeah, has it properly gone now?
Yeah.
And there's a sign there with sort of his decaying classic car collection saying that, you know, this is the penance one pays for being the kind of man that Escobar was. And of course he was a despicable blight on the face of Colombia and its history, but I don't think that's a reason to kind of erase him altogether. And I'm sort of saddened that there wasn't some way in which his life or perhaps his involvement in the property hadn't been brought a little bit more to
yeah,
bear.
Yeah, you know, previously it sort of did, and now they've kind of, you know, pushed
backed
it away. And it's just that the kind of argument about, like, the Escobar tour in Medellin, most of Paisas, for example, are against it. But at the same time, you know, it's very present history. It's very,
exactly,
very contemporary history. But at the same time, I am absolutely certain that Hacienda Nápoles would do incredibly well, knocking down its sort of cement figures of dinosaurs,
exactly,
and making it more of it doesn't need to be a pilgrimage site.
No, not an homage to Escobar, but something that perhaps just explains his role in Colombia's history.
You know,
because not all of a country's history can be universally good. Sometimes you have to have some slightly more difficult subjects to contend with.
I think there's a scope now, maybe because you with your background in public relations in London, I think there's scope for us to put together a book called Narco Architecture.
Narchitecture,
exactly. Going around, because most of these buildings, I know there's one up here, most of these buildings are owned by the state and they are falling into
they are.
And it would be so interesting to sort of almost like, you know, when the let's say the American and English forces stormed Saddam Hussein's palace in Iraq. The gaudy nature of everything is okay. Iraq,
sort of Gaddafi's palaces.
Yeah, sort of the gold-plated AK-47s. Here, you could see the weird sort of, I don't know, stucco formations,
sure,
and bizarre things.
Yes.
There's a lot to be done, but it's so recent, this history. So I kind of understand.
Absolutely, and it's something that's very personal, and perhaps as expats, it's not our place
not
to
our
set
place.
The terms, really. But it just felt a little bit like he was being erased from the property.
And in a decade, they'll bring him back.
Yeah.
When they realise that there's an economic gain to be had to discuss.
Exactly,
this,
the
know,
role that he played.
I feel that in Colombia there's a lot of things that are brushed under the carpet, and for good reason, of course, and they want to be forgotten. But at the same time, this conversation needs to remain open.
Indeed.
And so in that area, you were in the sort of Medio Magdalena, Baja Magdalena, you've been travelling around, and also you went into Onda in a place called Armero.
Armero, yes.
Tell us about Armero, because I don't know if a lot of the listeners will know about it.
Well, I certainly didn't before I came here. The site of a horrendous kind of apocalyptic landslide in 1985, which I think perhaps for a few weeks reached the world's media and then slipped away. It remains absolute site of desolation. There is literally nothing there. It's got a kind of haunting stillness. You look up at the Nevada del Ruiz, which was the volcano that caused the landslide in the first place. You can find a kind of 500-ton rock atop what once was someone's house. There are the sort of fragmented shells of certain other buildings now overgrown with plants, and that's really it. Neither man nor building survives.
Nor beast. Yeah. 30 years ago, 30th anniversary of that.
Yeah.
Now, I remember that I was 8 or 9 years old, my father making me watch that, and there's that very, you know, poignant and very, it's a chilling image of the young girl, Amaya.
And there's, to this day, a very well-attended shrine to her there. I mean, the poor thing spent, I think, a few days trapped, submerged in water, up to her shoulders. I think she was stood atop her dead aunt's head or something. Oof. Horrendous. The eyes of the world on her. She was giving interviews from this position. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't find a way to retrieve her, to get her out. And I think she finally succumbed to gangrene, which must have been a horrendous, probably painful death.
She was 13 years old? Something
yeah, like 12 or 13, so kind of young enough for it. Well, I mean, any death is obviously a huge, huge tragedy, but old enough to kind of understand what was happening. And some of the comments she made, you know, asking about her mother, who was away in Bogota at the time, you know, to be looked after, and it's that kind of strange juxtaposition between someone who has some adult understanding and yet is inherently obviously a child, and you know, at the same time as expressing concerns about who was going to care for her family. She was saying, oh, but today I was meant to have my maths test, and you know, I don't know how I'm going to have that, which is a very childish sort of reinforces how young she actually was, and what a kind of horrendous, horrific experience to have had to endure.
And you know, and as you said, you have that very good word there, the juxtaposition about the math test, and of course then the selfless worry about, you know, and she's up to her neck in mud and debris. Terrifying stuff. I mean, I remember that because I remember, you know, obviously I was aware of life and death, but I remember, you know, I remember asking my father, so what's going to happen? She's going to die there.
Yeah.
You know, and that whole having to sort of, you know, register in my head that there's nothing
that
anyone
can
do. Anyway, so now, back then in 1985, and I was at Faulkner House in Notting Hill Gate. back then in 1985, the Pope came, right? Or was it 1986?
In the immediate aftermath, so I don't know precisely when, but he came, he laid a cross, or it's actually quite a monumental structure, about the only structure that there is in Almere, obviously the rest of it having been largely decimated, and blessed the site. And now there's talk that this November, Pope Francisco is going to make a return journey to mark the 30th anniversary.
It would be amazing. I mean, it would be amazing to coincide with that. And I'm sure he's aware. I mean, this guy, he's a Latin American.
Yeah.
He's very much in the word that always comes up with me for Latin America, solidaridad.
Yeah.
Solidarity with
Absolutely.
His fellow Latinos. So that would be amazing. So I guess it was John Paul who came.
Yeah.
And then now we've got Francisco who's going to come. Now, and I, my wife and I, did drive through there once as we were trying to come back to Bogota through a different route to avoid some other landslides. And yeah, we noticed it. We didn't even know we were going through there until we noticed. And then, you know, Albert has quietly whispered, "We're in Almere."
Yeah.
And you see it. And there is that feeling that you know, something of great emotional importance took place there. You know, it is.
Yeah.
It's just, it's terrible. Do you even know how many people perished and died?
I think of a town of about 27,000, around something like 20,000 perhaps. It's a very, very high proportion of the town simply died.
They were all in their beds.
They were all in their beds. I think there'd been an issue to do with warning that, because obviously normally volcanoes are relatively easy to predict, but there'd been an error in terms of the warning, or there'd been a storm and they couldn't send the planes up to check the volcanic activity, so everyone was kind of taken unawares, and I think the scale and the speed with which the landslide happened meant that most people simply didn't have an option.
And it took place in November, that's when it was.
Yeah.
Okay, so I do know someone who's a survivor. I know of someone, so I'm going to have to get together with them to do pieces, because I'm sure there'll be a call for submissions on that in the international press.
Well, I kind of hope so, because I know when we were chatting earlier, we were saying about kind of international disasters and those that have kind of achieved legacy within perhaps all of our memories, the likes of Chernobyl or what have you, and for whatever reason Almere doesn't seem to have that, and yet having visited it, whilst it's something that is absolutely categorically not to be in any way celebrated, I think it is something that should be remembered and marked, so I hope that something is done.
It would be great. I mean, you think about that, because it's an era, obviously, pre-internet, pre-really world news, immediate world news, pre-everything. I mean, I was in 98, 99, I was there in Central America during Hurricane Mitch. People still talk about that.
Yeah.
You know, the region is only just now recovering. It's now, it's almost a decade later, you know.
Absolutely, and for whatever reason, Almere can't be rebuilt, I think partly as a kind of shrine to what happened, and partly out of fear that it may perhaps happen in the future. They've moved Almere I mean, kind of oddly, about 500 meters rather, to the right, just out of the main path of the problems.
This has happened in various places as well. What's the place in Peru where the people go climbing? I can't ever remember the name. It's Huancayo. Does that sound about right? Well, there was a landslide or avalanche or sort of took out the town, and they moved it sort of 200 meters up the hill. You know, after everyone's. Well, anyway, we're talking to Francesca Tarrant here on Columbia Calling. If you want to get in touch with this public relations specialist here in from London, who's here in Columbia, she is freelance, she is available for work. Please, you can get through to her via Columbia Calling. That's Columbia Calling on Facebook, Columbia Calling at Gmail, and of course ColumbiaCallingRadio.com. We have one of those forms on there, and then we're on Twitter at Columbia Calling. So we're all over social media, like everyone should be. We're talking about Columbia. We're talking about Armero, we've talked about Escobar, Puerto Triunfo, and a little bit of other things, but we're going to come right back in just a minute after this break and continue to talk about life in Colombia, according to Francesca Tarrant. Thank you for being on the show. Thank you for listening, everyone. We will be right back. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. We're here with Francesca Tarrant. I almost said something else. Francesca Tarrant. Thank you for being on the show. Sorry for almost getting your surname wrong.
No problem.
And we're talking about Columbia. We're talking about her life here in Columbia. We're talking about current events in Columbia. And it's the 30th anniversary this year, this November, of the disaster of the Armero. Just Google it. Armero. It's a dreadful, dreadful natural disaster that wiped out a town, more or less, in, I guess, on the Tolima border Caldas, I guess, is kind of close to there. And so sort of as you're leaving Bogota, descending in the Magdalena River Valley, going up towards the coffee area, it's that kind. And if you need to find it on a map, look for Onda, so the last navigable point on the River Magdalena. Anyway, so we're talking about that, and one of the things that came out of the Armero disaster was, and it's now sort of, you know, raising its head, people are starting to come to terms with it, that many children were just sort of
disappeared,
but I don't want to say disappeared, they were just sort of swept off, weren't they, and given up for adoption, even though family members were still alive. You know, there were those who, of course, had no, who, you know, would have been orphans, but then it was an opportunistic situation where people sold children off into adoption. And now stories have been popping up in the Colombian press in the last few years. I know out of Holland, you know, children who don't, well, adults now, 30 years old, 32, who speak no Spanish but know that they're Colombian and have been able to trace back to Armero. In the United States, there are a couple too. I'm sure they're all over the place. But it's an issue here, isn't it, with adoptions. I know that now adoptions are incredibly slow-paced and difficult.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of regulations in place, possibly with good reason, although extended bureaucracy is probably quite a painful part of the process for most parents looking to adopt. But I think then, perhaps in the aftermath and chaos following Armero, it was quite easy for opportunistic sort of underhandedly entrepreneurial Colombians to take advantage of the situation, perhaps, and rehouse some of these children, perhaps, you know, significantly for the better. But I think there's a big debate about whether or not it is right to remove children from their birth families.
Yeah, I think when it comes back to it, I think that's the main crux of any argument.
Absolutely.
Those of you who've been listening to the show for, well, 87, 88 episodes that we've had will remember the show that we had with José Luis and Marcela Mariscal of Sea Columbia Travel, who actually ended up helping a lady raised in the United States who was seized age 3 in a park in southern Bogota and given up for adoption. She's had clearly a much better life in I think it's Colorado, in fact, where she's from, somewhere like that, or California. Anyway, she'd come down through Sea Columbia Travel to find her roots and everything, and they managed to get it on RCN and Caracol TV, and someone in Venezuela, who was an extended family member, went, she looks exactly like my mum. And through that, and on her last day in Bogota, she was put back in touch.
That's incredible.
And it is an incredible thing. And you can see it on YouTube. Just look up the Sea Colombia Travel website. And so I think it's seacolombia.travel, and you'll find it up there. You look at adoption. And it's an amazing story, and it gives you chills.
Yeah.
Because they're identical. And, of course, she can't speak Spanish.
Yeah.
So Marcela's there. Well, she was 3 years old. All she remembered is she was in a park standing next to a lady in a long black dress. So she goes, I want to see every park in Colombia, in Bogota.
Till something rings a bell.
Do you know how many parks there are in Bogota? I mean, you know, so how many children have been through this situation? How much has this happened?
And I think, you know, there's a lot to be said about due diligence when it comes to adoption to enable children to be able to come back and retrace their steps. Mm. If they so wish, there's no doubt that... you know, the orphanages in Bogota are bulging at the seams with children who, it would appear, have nobody, and of course are fully entitled to a lovely life with parents who will indulge and cherish them. But I think, you know, they will always have an equal right to know where they came from, know their provenance, and be able to trace their families if they so wish.
Yeah. Now, you and I, this is sort of filtering on a little bit, we were both at the Anato Tourism Fair.
Indeed.
And before we get into the crux of tourism here in Colombia and how you found this, I met at that fair. It's like speed dating for travel agencies and hotels. You get 20 minutes with a bunch of agencies, international agencies of your choice. Anyway, I met with a lady called Bambi Wineland, great name. She has an agency in Boulder, Colorado, and it's called Motherland Travel. She only organizes travel from the US for parents, for adults who have adopted children from other countries. So she only does tailor-made trips to take those people, the adopting parents, with their adoptive children back to you know, get to know where they're from. I mean, what a marker.
An inspired project as well.
Yeah, and she's got lots and lots of business in Colombia and Guatemala, that's what she was saying.
Yeah.
And then it just so happened that I've got a good friend from New Jersey who now lives in the same city in Boulder, Colorado, who was adopted age 2 from Colombia. So I'm going to put them in touch.
Absolutely.
Good vibes, you know?
Yeah.
You're doing something.
That's an article waiting to be written.
I hope so. Well, she's going to come down here, and she's, you know, who knows when she's going to come, but she will come,
yeah.
And we will do a piece around it, because and you know, I know a friend again from Spain who did this, who followed another mutual friend who had been abandoned in the street, aged 1 or something like that, and given, you know, then the police had obviously given her to an orphanage. She came back age 22, 23. She's French, but looks Colombian. She can't pronounce her R's, you know. Ojoja is her name, not Aurora. And when they took her into the orphanage, you know, 23 years later, the director of the orphanage went, "You're Aurora." You know, without any introduction or anything, "I know you, you're Aurora."
That's amazing.
So I'm hoping for that sort of thing, that sort of story.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, let's move on from that. The Anato Tourism Fair. Now, I've been attending this for 7 years, so maybe I'm a little bit jaded. Maybe I'm a little bit, you know, tired. Tired of these things and the gloss. But tell everyone out there, Francesca, your impressions of Colombia's efforts to promote itself to the world.
I actually thought it was pretty comprehensive. I, too, have a background of travel fairs, having... in my previous job, worked with various tourist boards and destinations. So World Travel Market in London had been a regular haunt for me. And I have to say, this was a slightly more enlightening experience. Just had that little bit of Latino spirit and flair running through it that made it sort of all the more charming. Plus, they were serving booze, cocktails, and all sorts of...
Not to me.
...handy concoctions if you hit the right spots from about 10:30 in the morning, which is never going to sort of diminish enthusiasm amongst the punters. But no, I thought it was a pretty good overview of all that Colombia had to offer. And in a way, it's a shame that it was restricted to the travel industry, because... Mm. What it did do was offer a great showcase of the diversity of this country, which is what I spend my days rhapsodizing about to friends and family who seem to see it as a war-torn, sort of guerrilla-riddled land, when in reality it has a hugely diverse tourism proposition.
Mm. Well, you know, and actually I've had an argument on a Facebook forum this week, and because, as you know, I chaperoned A.A. Gill, who wrote a very, very good article,
fantastic piece.
In the Sunday Times last weekend about Bogota, and, you know, he, and of course he introduces it with like every journalist, he introduces it, putting in the historical context.
Of course.
And someone put onto Facebook, oh, you know, it's now time that we should go back, we should do this. And I responded, I really think this is a moot point, because we have to put it into context.
Absolutely.
We have to draw on the history. And I don't like, you know, it's one of those unsaid things. It's part of an interest in what people have is to see the change.
Absolutely, and I think to deny it would be doing Colombia a disservice.
Mm-hmm. You know,
and I think to write a sort of very light, fluffy travel piece that just looks at the very, very positive sides to Colombia's tourism proposition, of which there are many, would be doing a huge disservice to the country. I think that transformation is actually one of its greatest selling points, and I think that when he wrote the piece, Adrian Gill communicated that perfectly. Mm. I think he was so positive about so many aspects within the city and within Colombia more generally that for me, like you say, it's a bit of a moot point that he set it against the backdrop of the war and so on.
But there still is conflict out there.
Course.
I mean, on the border with Arauca down in Putumayo, only on Tuesday a report came out that there's 110 square hectares per day is lost to coca plantations.
Absolutely.
In Colombia between 98 and 2012. I mean, so, you know, there are still issues out there. Okay, it's a good place to invest, you know, things are getting better, everything keeps improving, but we can't lie.
I agree, and actually this is a point that I raised with a few of the tour operators that we met at Anate, because I work with a UK and Argentina-based travel company, Plan South America, and they recently launched in Colombia. And as a result, obviously a lot of the kind of the tour operators are keen to collaborate with us, looking at kind of diverse itineraries and that sort of thing. And there are certain destinations, and perhaps they're slightly more front of mind because of the security measures that get sort of rammed down our throats at the embassy. But nonetheless, there are areas that are out of bounds. There are areas that the Foreign Office, as a rule, will say are inadvisable to visit. And yet a lot of these travel companies will come out and say, no, Colombia's now perfectly safe. And you think, actually, you're doing, again, a great disservice to your proposition. What you should be saying is there are certain areas now which are largely unexplored, which you can now discover, these wonderful areas that you can visit safely. But, you know, Colombia is Colombia, and I don't think allowing aspects of its more challenging situation to be communicated is hindering selling it as a destination.
I think it's true, but I mean, we received an absolute shot in the arm, whether you're a royalist or not, with Prince Charles's visit, going as far down as Chiribiquete, you know, in Caquetá, which I've been to, which was, just look up some of my articles, that was pretty hair-raising, but he flew in and flew out, I went by canoe. and of course, Caño Cristales, which is
just
a phenomenal place. I mean, the most otherworldly part of Colombia, with that red river, the Purple River. But it's one of these things, you know, the travel here, and you know, I sit down and I introduce myself, and you know, I've been there for 7 years. At this meeting. You know, most people have an idea who I am, and I show them the Michelin guide, which I wrote, and I'm finished the Brat guide, and I write for all these people and stuff. I say, listen, please, it doesn't matter if you're going to work with me. Come to my hotel, do whatever you want. If you are interested in sending people all over the country and they have security, you know, issues about the security situation, just get in touch.
Yeah.
Because as a journalist writing news about here, I'm a bit more informed and I can tell you what's going on at that time.
Absolutely. It's more
key.
At the cut and thrust. Yeah. And it does change, not quite on a 6 months, but at relatively short notice. And I think the kind of travellers that Colombia is attracting internationally are people who understand and appreciate, and as you said, actually almost welcome that. They aren't coming to Colombia expecting to be spending a weekend in Miami. They're coming to Colombia because they want to get to grips with its cultural heritage, and they want to see it within its full context. And I think having someone like you who can explain it to them in a way, sort of the good, the bad, and the ugly, as well as all the great things, will enhance their experience.
And we need to be level-headed about this. Colombia is going to increase in leaps and bounds.
Yeah.
But let's not, you know, let's say run before we can walk. Let's get it right. And the worst thing that could possibly happen is something terrible happens to a tourist.
Which is exactly what I was saying as kind of a cautionary tale when I was meeting with these tour operators, is that if you start selling places that are sort of slightly more risky and something does happen and you've been selling them as being perfectly safe, then you'll undo all the good work that has been done in the last few years to get Colombia to the position where it's a very tempting destination for a lot of international visitors.
And rounding up this thing about Anato, so downstairs in the pavilions around, so all this is a show of all of Colombia's diversity, and it should be open to the public. But, you know, Bogota should be in there going, where can I explore? Because it would get them past their core fear about travelling around Colombia too, you know?
I agree. Because, and it's amazing in the embassy even that there are still a number of British people living here who don't perhaps know what there is within Bogota, let alone wider Colombia. And I think something like that would help them to perhaps open their eyes and have a greater understanding of all that there is here and the amazing things that there are on offer.
Positive things, though, I came out of the Anato, I would say, too. It's the first year out of seven that I would really say that the travel agencies, the international travel agencies that who were invited and came and did fan trips, were genuinely interested in let's say, the second wave or the third wave of destinations in Colombia.
Great.
Because any clown can get on a plane from Miami or New York to Cartagena now, or to Barranquilla, or to Bogota.
Yeah.
So being an agency, you need to look further.
I think that's absolutely a reflection of that kind of travel market anyway, and I know that working in the sort of luxury travel sector previously, provenance, heritage, getting off the beaten track, self-discovery, is there are things that matter more to tourists than perhaps staying in a Hilton or a Marriott. And I found it interesting that, obviously, the likes of the major hotel groups had their presence at Anato. Although I have to say, if they do proliferate within Colombia, I think it will be to the detriment of the special spirit that Colombia does have. I mean, personally speaking, I would far rather stay in your Casa Maria Montpoz than were there to be a kind of Marriott located 500 yards down the road for that kind of generic international experience. And likewise, I know when we're planning itineraries for clients coming with Plan South America, it's a question of finding these haciendas, it's a question of finding these boutique hotels with people who understand Colombia and aren't just selling a sort of generic tourism proposition. But it's a fantastic idea that they are looking at this, the next generation of destinations, because there is just so much on offer here. It's jaw-dropping.
We still get it. We still offer here in Colombia authenticity.
Yeah.
I think that's the word at the end of it, you know. And people, in my opinion, you know, those who are coming to for example, Montpoz, are not looking for iPod docking stations in the bathroom.
No.
They just want it clean. They want their relative comfort and good service.
Absolutely.
They're not looking for it, because it's not for that kind of person. That's not to say we haven't received that kind of person who are just being, you know, locked themselves in a room for the day and then written me an email to complain that it was too hot.
Well,
I was like, you know,
how could you not have changed the weather?
You know, I'm sorry. Anyway, let's move on about that, because I can rant about these people all day. We've got a few minutes left, but I want to talk about something that's been going on recently, which is all over the news and will probably make some international news at some point, just because it's like a meme at the moment, and it also highlights an ugly side to Colombia, is that of this sort of stratification of the social classes. A young 29-year-old man, let's say young in spirit, because he was completely drunk, hopped in a cab 26.5 kilometres outside of Bogota in a town called Chía, where that famous restaurant Andrés Carne de Res is, took a cab all the way into the Bogota there to go to the Zona Rosa to then go out on a night out. Anyway, he was refused entry to the clubs and also did not want to pick up his $100 bill for the cab ride, so 200,000 pesos. This might be expensive. In truth, it probably is expensive, but you don't argue with the taxi drivers, because the first thing they do is call all their friends and then they surround you. So the police arrived because they saw all the taxis, you know, threatening this guy. Anyway, he then basically picks a fight with the police.
Yes.
His name is Nicolas Gaviria, 29 years old, of, let's say, upper class Colombia. Yeah, let's. He is related to an ex-president, but the next president, Cesar Gaviria, who was on a plane to Spain at the moment it happened, then released a statement going, he's a tertiary family member. If there's ever a great put down, you know, it's a tertiary. So I would say he's like, not even a second cousin, third removed, you know, it's like, anyway, but it was disgusting. I mean, it was recorded by the police and someone else there.
They recorded, I think they had quite the crowd by the end of it, from the looks of things, as one would if you had a sort of baying crowd of taxi drivers and a jumped up Hooray Henry starting on the cops. That is likely to draw a crowd, even in Bogota on a Saturday night. And it is disgusting behaviour, and it shouldn't be condoned.
You know, it wasn't like Hooray Henry. It was a city boy or a Wall Street boy, but without, like, let's say, the cojones, I think. Because, you know, there he was. He's basically being held back by the police, not aggressively so, because he was being really over boisterous, let's say.
Yes.
And then in his drunken idiocy, his phrase was "Ustedes no saben quién soy yo," which is the hashtag now. You don't know who I am. Do you know who I am?
That hashtag has just taken off. That is one of those ghastly phrases that you might expect to hear on the King's Road. Yeah. Some dreadful, slowly Hooray Henry trying to get into a club. But you don't see it that much here, or I haven't seen it to date that much here. And so it's come as a bit of a shock, I think, that. And it's a sad side of Colombian society. Yeah, it's a sad reflection on Colombian society that it's kind of come to this.
But you know, so obviously, you know, we have stratos 1 to 6, and it's sort of, you know, in your district. So I would say in England or wherever, what W2, W1, SW11 will all be strato 6, you know, the most expensive. So Rosales and of course where the Zona Rosa would be strato 6, but this boy's you know, behaving as if he's strato 21, you know, and then he said, you know, he threatened a policeman saying he'd have him sent to the Chocó, which is the impoverished but mega diverse region on the western Pacific coast of Colombia, that one of the most beautiful points on earth. And so people are then leaping up going, so how many rich kids do I need to insult to get a free trip out to the Chocó?
Give me his number. Yeah.
Send me to the Chocó. I love it.
I'll happily abuse him.
What was the other thing? He said, what education do you have, to a policeman too? And so, of course, you know, Twitter and Facebook and all the comments just basically collapsed on
Absolutely.
Social media.
Quite right too.
So, I mean, it really raised a very ugly side of Colombian, let's say, elitism. So, you know, I've got the surname, I've had the education, I'll get you sent off to a region that's primarily inhabited by descendants of former black slaves, and that's impoverished and you know, overlooked, disease ridden.
Yeah.
I mean, what else did he say? I can't even remember, but it was just really unpleasant.
It was a pretty ghastly tirade, and it went on for quite a while, and I think the police actually demonstrated a huge amount of self-restraint.
That was one of the things that someone actually posted online. It's like, if only Colombia had the same patience as those two policemen.
Yeah.
But they did him a favour, and then of course he was let off. I mean, he made a big show about calling up the you know, someone that he knew in the police, but they're now in an investigation into that to see that if he did receive favours, you know, and curry favours. But it's just kind of saddening, you know. But again, this is like we were talking about the Escobar, Pablo Escobar issue. But these are conversations that need to be had still in Colombia.
Definitely, and I think the stratification of Colombia is probably holding it back a little bit as well in terms of. Sort of putting it on the world map, and occasions like this where someone does behave in such a disgraceful fashion. Okay, maybe it's not the worst thing that has ever happened here, and it is ultimately
a silly little
rich kid complaining ultimately about paying a taxi fare and behaving in an obnoxious fashion of pataleta that he's having in front of the police. But that doesn't make it right, and I think actually credit to it being this social media storm, because it is highlighting that you can't get around behaving like that, even if your tertiary relation was in fact president.
Yes, this is true. Now, one other thing you were saying is this might be impeding or prohibiting Colombia's advance a little bit. I did hear through the grapevine that the Colombia will not be admitted into the OECD countries until they reform the tax laws which favour the rich.
Well, Quite so, right too.
There you go. There you go. A little bit of bureaucracy.
Yeah.
A little bit of bureaucracy. How can you reform something that's so engendered in society?
Exactly.
I don't know. But fascinating stuff. Poor old Nicolas Gaviria. Everyone knows who you are because of something ridiculous that you did.
Exactly. Shame on him.
Even I think it was George Bush's daughter spent a night in the clink for drunkenness. Jenna Bush, was it Jenna,
I think
or
it was
the other one?
One of the twins did have a bit of a drunken, disorderly situation.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
And I remember one of the Blair kids being picked up in
Jack Straw's son, also, wasn't he?
Yeah, you're right. So everyone's all, you know, I mean, come on, put him in the drunk tank for a night and give him an ASBO.
Exactly.
So like,
put a bracelet on him,
or you know, tattoo his forehead. anyway, it's very funny, and that's absolutely, you know, completely just devoured the news media here, despite what's going on in Cuba with the FARC and all the arguments about transitional justice.
Yeah.
We won't see a day in prison. We're no guerrilla. I've written an editorial about this. It'll be out in the City paper shortly. Believe you me, transitional justice, International Criminal Court, the Rome Statute, there will be guerrillas who spend time in jail because they can be connected to genocide, to extrajudicial killings, to disappearances and crimes against humanity. That is the truth, and it can be backdated till 2002. There you go.
I would say so.
Francesca, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. We've had it's been a fun conversation.
It has.
Yeah, there we go. We've talked about everything. We've covered everything. We've covered class, we've covered travel, we've covered disasters, we've covered hooray Henrys. But anyway, listen, it's been very, very a great pleasure to have you on the show. If anyone wants to get in touch with Francesca, anyone who needs freelance PR work or writing or copywriting, she is here in Bogota. She is available for freelance jobs. You can get through to her just by emailing us at columbiacalling@gmail.com, website columbiacallingradio.com, even Twitter at columbiacalling, and leaving us a message, or via Facebook, of course. We're on that too, Columbia Calling. So listen, thank you for tuning in. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We'll have plenty more shows in the pipeline. I've got new people lined up each week from here on in. Don't know how long for, but equally, as long as they keep giving me this platform, I will still be here. Thank you to the 6,000 odd of you who continue to download each week on iTunes and other platforms. I've been Richard McCall. This has been Columbia Calling. Please stay tuned. Thank you very much.